let me introduce you to a new book by Simon Bowne. Verified Near-Death Experiences. Simon Bowne, acclaimed podcaster and hypnotherapist, announces the release of his groundbreaking book, Verified Near-Death Experiences, Proof of an Afterlife. Through detailed accounts of events observed during clinical death and startling moments of validation, Simon Bowne offers compelling insights into the mysteries of the afterlife. Verified Near-Death Experiences is a thought-provoking book that will leave readers questioning what lies beyond. Available soon.
This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 166, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. And you can enjoy the extended version of this episode ad-free, along with over 160 hours of extended episodes, on Patreon. This week, I'm talking to Whitley Strieber about his book, The Fourth Mind. Whitley started his writing career with The Wolfen in 1979, and since then he's written over 40 books. Whitley's ET experiences started in 1985, and his groundbreaking book, Communion, was made into a movie starring Christopher Walken. His contact with the entities he calls the Visitors have continued to this day. Well, hi, Whitley. Thanks a lot for coming to the podcast.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, we're going to talk about your book. It's called The Fourth Mind. Can you just tell us, what do you mean by The Fourth Mind?
The Fourth Mind is a way of being that we possessed a very long time ago and we could regain. The beings I call the Visitors, you can see the picture of the lady over on the wall and the picture of the Fourth Mind behind me, have this. And it consists of a number of powers, the power of levitation, the power of telepathy, the power of instantaneous movement, the power of self-healing, and probably others as well. They have all of these. I have observed a number of them in action. And in the first half of the book, I go into, in detail, the anatomy, the brain function, the spiritual beliefs of our visitors. In the second half of the book, I show how we once had the same powers that they do and why we lost them, which opens up the possibility, of course, of finding a way to regain them.
I was interested to read about this document, which was put on Reddit and sent to you in 2024.
The Reddit document was written by an anonymous biologist. And I don't follow Reddit, and I wasn't aware of the document. And a friend sent it to me saying he or she, I don't remember exactly who it was, thought it would be interesting to me. And it was. It was very interesting because of three reasons. Well, first, I've known we had bodies of non-human entities. This was something I found out from General Arthur Exon, who was commanding officer at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in the 60s, a friend of the family, and who was with my uncle Mickey at the Air Materiel Command at what was then called Wright Field in 1947-48, when the debris and bodies from Roswell, the Roswell crash, were brought in. And after I published my book, Communion, in 1988, my uncle got in touch with me and said, there's something I and a friend of mine would like to talk to you about. And my uncle told me of what had happened at Wright Field and introduced me to General Exon, who told me more, including the fact that we had bodies. I determined over the years that those bodies were at Fort Detrick in Maryland. And I never saw them. I was never able to network to anyone who was working on them, but I knew they were there. Then this document shows up on Reddit, and lo and behold, it's from a biologist who says he worked at Fort Detrick. It was not generally known that the bodies were there. It's not in the UFO literature anywhere, I don't think. And I was intrigued because by 2024, I have encountered and seen the visitors physically many, many times at this point in my life. And so I thought to myself as I was reading the document, I can actually compare my own observations with what's in this document. And I can show, for once, as a beginning, I can show how these bodies work and what they are like. And I'm going to be able to discuss their brain function and all kinds of things. So that's how it started. As to who wrote the document, I have no idea at all. I don't know anything about Reddit. I mean, you can't find, if someone is anonymous on Reddit, I think you probably have to get a court order to find out who they are.
So did you see loads of stuff in this document that you read it and thought, but I've seen that myself in the visitors. This guy knows what he's talking about.
In detail. In fact, one thing in the document is only in two places, in my personal observations and in the document, nowhere else. It's not commented on or discussed anywhere else in any literature. Therefore, there's no question in my mind that the document is authentic because it's a very unusual thing. And I saw it. I saw it being done. And he describes it very accurately in the document.
So is there a date on the document, you know, when it was written?
I don't recall a date, no, but it appeared in 2024, that I do know.
So when you talked to General Arthur Exon, and he told you, or you heard about these bodies, you haven't talked about this before, is that right? This is the first time you're saying you had that info.
I believe I've mentioned from time to time that he said there were bodies. In fact, I'm sure I have. But he didn't say much. And especially, he said it to a relative, not directly to me. He confirmed to me that there had been bodies there, that they had bodies. But he didn't describe them. He described them to one of my relatives. I asked him when I was first talking to him whether or not bodies had been brought in. And he said, well, we found out very quickly that they weren't children. That was how he responded. And they initially thought, because of their size, that they were children. And then they thought, when they looked at them, that they were children who had been altered by some process developed by the Nazi monster Joseph Mengele, and that's what they had. Then they had been sent by the communists, by Stalin, and that they were somehow altered in this by this thing. And then, as General Exon said to me, and I've quoted him many times on this, he said, "Everyone from Truman on down knew that what we had found was not of this world within 24 hours of our finding it." Those are his exact words.
And it's been covered up ever since. And I imagine that less and less people know, and the presidents aren't told about it anymore.
Well, the cover-up is collapsing slowly. It's in a sort of slow decline. And enough people have come forward, Lou Elizondo, David Grush, and others have come forward, and have described their own knowledge and experiences. Jake Barber, who came forward just 2 weeks ago, has described in detail his experiences, and they do involve direct contact with these beings. And I can tell you a lot about them. I mean, we can tell you a great deal about them. So,
you mentioned earlier about their spiritual beliefs. So does that mean that they've got a religion, or is it something entirely different to that?
Well, I have the one part of the Reddit document that made me feel that this night might have been something that was made up was the part about their spiritual beliefs, because it is very similar. They are very similar to the beliefs about the structure of reality that you see in the work of the Jesuit Pierre Teilhard de Chardin and in his idea of the noosphere. What they basically believe is that consciousness is pervasive and it is seeking more and more complication, more and more expression into more and more different directions, and that this is negative entropy in action. In other words, consciousness, as consciousness grows, the meaning of reality becomes richer and richer and richer. And this is somewhat similar to Chardin's idea, Teilhard's idea. So there's no indication that they have a religion, because they haven't extracted their gods from their psychology like we have. In other words, gods are expressions. Gods are part of the human psyche that are expressed into an external form. Like if you read the stories of the Greek gods and their interactions with each other, after a while you think to yourself, my God, I'm reading a soap opera. And you are. You're reading a story of the interactions of within the psyche and the psyche's interactions with other people. And if you look into the very deep and complex constructions that are called the Hindu deities, you will find that they are really subtle expressions of human psychology. These are psychological artifacts from the distant past, gods. And what happened in the middle years of the Roman, or the early years of the Roman Empire, the advent of Christianity, you had a situation where suddenly this richness was narrowed down into a single deity who left us entirely and became something out in the distance in heaven to be worshipped. And we don't have any real access to this energy anymore within ourselves. And we have, in recent years, we foundered and we wandered for 1,000 years of a religious dictatorship in the Western world. And over time in the Eastern world, the gods gradually became personified, so that you see, and you go to India and you see statues everywhere. And or in the Buddhist areas, Buddha said, don't make any images of me. And the first thing you see when you go to Bodh Gaya, which is in India, the heart of Buddhism, and where the Bodhi tree originally was, that under which Buddha was enlightened, the first thing you see is a gigantic statue of Buddha, at least 100 feet tall. And so we did something that they haven't done. I don't think they've externalized any of these psychological factors. Their gods are still within them. And that's part of the reason that they're so much more powerful in the world and able to connect with the earth, or the physical world, so fluently and capably, where we have to fly around in jets. They can move from place to place instantaneously, where we have to go into the hospital to be cured. They can do it as a community and bring health back to anyone who is injured, and many times also to people who are sick, beings who are sick.
So this idea that we had the fourth mind and we lost it,
Yes.
Do the visitors want us to get it back? Are there some visitors who are trying to help us with it?
Well, I think they're being here and having someone like me peering at them is going to make it. They're going to help us get it back, whether they want to or not. I'm not really interested in their motives and aims, except insofar as they help us or hurt us. I've not seen any indication of them sitting down with somebody and saying, look, here's what you have to do. But they demonstrate it by the way they live. They're fluently telepathic. I have telepathy with them quite frequently. And I'm not alone. Hundreds of thousands of people, maybe millions of people around the world have telepathy with them as well. It's not difficult. But when you're not with them, then it is difficult. It wasn't always the case. We have in our world people who are unvoiced, autistic, and telepathic. There is a doctor, Diane Hennessy Powell, who has proved this without question, and a documentary filmmaker and podcaster, Kai Dickens, who has shown it to be true. She has interviewed people who are involved in this. The visitors are unvoiced. They don't have vocal cords, and they don't have a syrinx. A syrinx is what a bird uses to make notes. They can make a cry, a oh kind of cry, which when you hear it turns out to be the most emotionally rich sound you will ever hear in your life. So they're not exactly helpless in terms of sound. But instead of voice, they use telepathy, and they have a communal mind, individual personalities, and some of them are very individual, believe me. But the community shares its thoughts always. In this universe, I think they're one of the ways that dividing species is probably by those that are voiced and those that are unvoiced. We use voice and sound for all kinds of communication. We have music. They do not have music. We have a written language. They have a hieroglyphic symbolic language. They don't have a language where you can put three letters together and then that to me, to you, means the word the. They don't have that. They have hieroglyphs like the Egyptians did, only they're much more subtle hieroglyphs. They're different, and they're much more poetic, among other things. I can't read them, but I can understand them. And they show me hieroglyphics quite frequently. And I said to them early on, I can't read your hieroglyphics. I have no idea what you're, and the idea, and this is all done telepathically. The idea was, yes, you can. Just relax. When you see it, you will know it. And it's true. I do get the information from these hieroglyphics when they show them to me. But I can't tell you a darn thing about what they say in words because it's not a spoken language. The hieroglyphics aren't a spoken language.
So there's a sentence in the book I was interested in. You said, instead of gently teaching us or explaining things to us, they are goading us into acting on our own behalf by doing things that we cannot tolerate. Is that like the abductions?
Yes, the abductions. They're going to stir the ant nest until we get mad enough to notice that they're here and start to stand on our own two feet. They're not going to colonize us culturally. They will not do that. That's not going to happen. They will, and I think they are succeeding in this, induce us to act on our own behalf, to act on our own behalf.
It's weird you say they're doing this so that we notice them, but they could just fly in the skies and just show themselves to us.
That would be true. They came into my life. They were in my life when I was a child, and they returned to my life in the summer of 1985. And over the course of the summer and into the fall, I did not notice finally, they showed up the day after Christmas and just essentially beat me up until I noticed. Let me give you another example of how profound this is. We used to have friends out to the cabin a lot after they showed up, because especially people who were interested and wanted to meet them, because that often happened. People, a lot of people met them at our cabin. And once we were there, I made a stone circle where they had originally, where I thought they had originally taken me up, although I'm not sure I was in the right place. That was fine. The circle was, that was where I was would take people. So a group of us were sitting in the circle, myself, my wife, my son, his young friend. They were probably about 9 or 10. Two friends, Marco Adler and John Glideman. Marco is a pet. They both deceased. One was an author. Marco wrote books about Wicca and things like that. She was also a broadcaster on NPR. John was a psychologist and a physicist. And then some other people, Peter Froh and Dora Ruffner, both also deceased now, and their daughter. So that we had a good group there, quite a group there. We were all sitting around the circle doing a meditation when suddenly this was in the middle of the day, this extraordinary beam of golden light that looked like a very thick laser, a foot thick, and it was gold. It was just beautiful. Came down into the middle of the circle. Everyone could see it. It was as clear as it could be, except one person, John, the physicist. If he had seen that, it would have caused his entire worldview to implode. And he couldn't see it. He couldn't see it. Afterwards, he got a horrible headache, incapacitating headache. He got that headache because that is when the brain is pushing something away that it cannot afford to see, you're liable to get a headache. All summer before the visitors finally showed up, I would get these headaches every day. And meantime, I was buying guns and I was putting an alarm system in the house. I was patrolling the house at night. I knew they were there. Couldn't see them. John couldn't see them. You might not be able to see them if they came into your house. See what I mean? So it's not going to be that easy. It's not going to be a landing. Maybe there's been many landings and we didn't see them. We pushed him away.
So it's some kind of psychological subconscious block. Is it that your brain sees it and doesn't allow that to get through to you?
Doesn't allow it to become inner consciousness. That's where the headache starts.
If you say that the human race had the fourth mind, was there a time, or did we lose it over a long period of time, or there was one event that caused us?
I think that what happened was this. First, if you look around the world, it is dotted with ruins that we cannot understand and can no longer create. The platform at Baalbek in Lebanon, 100-ton stones that no one now can move, let alone the ancient Romans who were supposed to be able to move them. The ancient Romans could maybe move a 40-ton block with the equipment that they had accessible, but not huge, unbelievable blocks like that. And not only that, where the blocks were quarried and where the platform is built, there's about a 1,500-foot area where they would have had to have been dragged across. Only there's no sign of that happening. There's no sign. There's no strengthening of the ground. No causeway. There's nothing. And yet, it was these huge blocks were cut and moved. Another ruin is the Nan Madol ruin in the Carolina Islands in the Pacific. 750,000 basalt logs, each of them carved out, each of them weighing tons, put together to create 11 artificial islands. Again, the quarry is not far away, but there's nobody in the past who lived in the Pacific area who could have quarried 750,000 of these very heavy blocks out of basalt, which is an extremely hard stone, and taken them. There's no engineering, that all of the engineering is impossible. Except it's not. There's also in Florida, in a little town in Florida, something called the Coral Castle. This was built between 1927 and 1953 by a man named Edward Leedskalnin from Latvia. He built this without any pulleys, anything. He did it in secret. He moved multiple ton stones by an unknown means, and no one ever saw him do it. From his quarry, again, not far from the Coral Castle. And he would say to people who asked, he said, "It's an ancient Egyptian secret." And he died with that secret. He was also very interested in magnetism, which may give us some kind of a hint of what the secret is. Now, this ability comes from way before, even before ancient Egypt. In my book, I show that there is substantial evidence that these abilities, now called Siddhis, S-I-D-D-I-S, were common to the human species before a certain geologic catastrophe occurred 12,000 years ago, which geologists call the Younger Dryas. They call it that because sudden changes in weather can be identified by the growth region of a plant called the Dryas. And the Younger Dryas is the second of these episodes. The first episode, the Older Dryas, was a sudden cooling that happened about 2,000 years before the Younger. And it wasn't as severe or as long. The Younger Dryas was very sudden and very severe. It led to things like the collapse of the Laurentide Glacier in North America. And sea levels rose over 400 feet worldwide in a matter of days. We have flood myths, the stories of Atlantis being drowned in a great flood. The floods certainly happened, but more happened than that. This started, let's go back a little farther. 30,000 years ago, there was a supernova that exploded. the gamma rays and light and other radiation from the supernova reached our solar system and reached Earth 30,000 years ago. It was very intense. To people living then, it would have looked like a second sun had appeared in the sky. There's a strip across parts of Southeast Asia and Australia where there were very localized extinctions. All of the great land marsupials, the large ones that were in Australia, died out at that time. And this was because all of the large creatures that lived outdoors were exposed to this gamma radiation and they died. Human beings were exposed to it too, to some extent, but they stayed in shelter because, you know, when a second sun appears, people are going to be very careful about what they do, whether or not they go out. So that was 30,000 years ago. supernovas do two things. They send out massive amounts of radiation and massive amounts of debris, heavy metal debris and stuff like that that comes out of the exploding star. The Earth's formed in the explosion, I should say, to be accurate. That debris reached Earth and reached the solar system 12,000 years ago. When it hit, this is why, by the way, there's stories always of mammoths being found with food still in their mouths, their carcasses in Russia and in Alaska. They will be found with food still in their mouths and dead. They literally died in an instant. And if you look into their bodies, you will find tiny bits of metal embedded in the bones. What happened to them was they were sheeted by high-speed micrometeorites that came in on this as this debris field reached our area. This went on for 1,000 years. The first thing it did was it set the entire North American continent on fire. This is recorded in geology by something called the Black Mat, which stretches from as far south as New Mexico and into northern Mexico, all the way up into the area that bordered what was then the glacier in the Midwestern United States and in the Eastern United States. This massive fire probably burned for many, many years. And it's what caused the sudden cooling of the Younger Dryas. The cooling was caused by a pall of smoke that lasted for years and years and years. During that time, there were meteor strikes and explosions out of the sun because of debris hitting the sun. And the entire planetary environment was in turmoil. This is where our stories of wars in space come from. The gods at war, because we looked up and we saw what was happening, and we had no way of explaining it except that the gods were having a war. And this went on and on and on. When it ended, the North American continent was burned to a cinder, but then it became very warm, and the Laurentide Glacier melted quite suddenly because of two things. First, it became much warmer, and second, more debris hit the glacier with such force that it broke it up. And the glacier came sliding down into the central United States and melted, leaving a lake that stretched from parts of Colorado and New Mexico all the way west to east of the Mississippi River near to the Appalachian Mountains. This massive lake took 1,000 years to drain off into the Gulf of Mexico. What it left behind was a mat that consisted of carbonized wood and the burning that had taken place, and the bones or the skeletons of algae. That's called the Black Mat, and you can dig down in many parts of the United States and find it. It's there. And this is what caused it. This immense catastrophe meant that essentially the entire human population of North America disappeared. The Clovis people were wiped out. All of the large animals in North America, the ground sloths, the camels, the horses, the woolly mammoths, the mastodons, all of the big animals were wiped out. The North American continent was left a gigantic, blackened mud hole, which happened to be extremely fertile land. So the plants soon came back. And by the time the Europeans arrived, North America was once again a verdant forest. You could never dream that that had even happened. In any case, while all of this was happening, we went into this, we didn't have egos like we have now. We didn't need them. We were not voiced because we didn't have language. We were telepathic. But under those circumstances, it was literally every person for themselves. You had to forage for yourself to live. The ego came. It's a survival mechanism. It came out of the need to survive. And with it, it brought a silencing of the telepathy and the end of our ability to use the energies of the earth in our works. And the movement of those great stones, which is such a mystery now, was done with the mind. And we can get it back. It's not gone.
The ETs, the visitors that might want to be helping us and, like you say, goading us with things we can't tolerate.
Right.
They want us to do it ourselves. It's not like they could come down and teach us.
You know, when you're training an animal, like a dog or a horse, you have to get through to them. A dog, you know, you like one of the ways you train a dog is you get a newspaper rolled up, and when the dog does something you don't like, you bop him on the nose with the newspaper. It makes a sound and it scares him and it gets his attention, but doesn't hurt him. And this is essentially what they do to us because they can't communicate with us. They're not voiced. And we can't communicate with them telepathically effectively except under very special circumstances. It has to be quiet. You can't, in the rush of a moment, you can't just go on into telepathy with them. It doesn't work. I know that. I've done that, tried to do that. You have to be quiet. You have to collect yourself. You have to be very calm. And then it works. But when they're trying to get through to you and to show you things and to, in effect, train you to them, tame you to them, rather, this is what they have to do. They have no choice. And so they can be very intense, and they also can be very frustrated. Just like when you're trying to get your dog to do something and the dog can't figure it out, you can get frustrated. It's exactly the same. They don't think of us as dogs, but this is the best they can do. Because it's one thing is very clear. They're not particularly good at contacting others. And that, to me, means that there are not many others in the universe. And we may even be the only ones they've ever found.
Do they have, like, families and friends? Did you ever meet a visitor over a period of time that sort of became friendly?
Oh, yes. We certainly did. We became extremely friendly. One of them, well, first, let me talk about how their social structure works. There are more than one. They function like an ant colony. They have many different forms, and each form is very much purpose-built. And this is the way they've evolved. The ones we studied at Fort Detrick are not biologic. They're bio-robots with extraordinarily big brains. I'll explain why that is in a minute. But they don't have any reproductive organs. In other words, they must be manufactured. Without reproductive organs, they're not reproducing. The big brains are there, though, because the ones who are biological are not fixed in their bodies like we are. In other words, they can enter and leave their bodies easily, and they can project their consciousness in part into these smaller ones and use them as kind of avatars. So if something happens to one of these things, it's okay. It doesn't matter. It didn't happen to me. I just pull my consciousness out of it. And this is why these are the ones who do the abductions and so forth. When a group of grays, of little 3-foot tall grays, walks into somebody's house to abduct them, that group is actually not a group of separate individuals. It's a group of avatars that are being controlled by someone who is well away, well out of harm, and that someone is biological. So that's how that works. It's a very, very different way of being and living than we have. The little ones are not independent entities, but they have very big brains because when these the biologically independent ones project their consciousness into this, there has to be enough. The brain has to mimic the brain of the individual, or it's not going to work. They have to be entrained. In other words, they have to be in sync. So this is why we some of us know this. This is why Jake Barber says that they shoot them down. And you know, nobody really cares. And that's quite true. Nobody does really care, except my experience of it. If you screw around with these little ones too much, they get mad. I mean, the big ones get mad because it's something that's costly to them. You know, they don't recreate them overnight, apparently. So
in a way, they're disposable.
They're sort of semi-disposable, I would say. It's like, you know, a very expensive something that you could throw away if you wanted to, or if it was destroyed, it wouldn't hurt you. But you'd rather that not happen.
Because it's one thing I wondered about, you know, if there are crashes like Roswell, why didn't the ETs have their own crash retrieval team or an ambulance? But for them, it's just the avatars.
There was a crash in West Virginia in 1952 that I go into in extensive detail in the book Them. And that crash was of one of the biological entities, and it escaped in a escape capsule that became known in the press as the Flatwoods Monster, because the escape capsule was designed to look very frightening in order to keep anything away from it. And inside that escape capsule was something much less formidable than what the people who saw it observed. So that can happen, and it's not something it would be a good idea to try to induce, because that would make them mad. That would definitely cause a fight. And they are, from all accounts, it's not a lot of fun to fight with them, and you can't win.
These small ones then could have been designed to work on Earth, because it seems like Yes. They're fine with our gravity and our atmosphere, and they don't need breathing apparatus.
They're purpose-built. That's a smart question. They're purpose-built, and I go in the fourth mind in detail as to exactly how their eyes work, how their bodies work, their level of strength, how their musculature works, and it becomes very clear that they are purpose-built to interact with us in various ways, including abduct us.
So is there a point in the book you talk about how you saw three greys outside and they were brushing stuff off their arms?
Yes, that's right. That was the tip-off from the Reddit document. No one has ever said anywhere that they had seen that, except I saw it. And it happened in my front yard. I was, at that time in my life, this was probably about 1990, somewhere in there, I was trying very hard to kind of tame them. They were like birds. I mean, you know, I'd see them, and then even thinking about walking over to them, like, poof, they'd just disappear before my eyes. So I was trying to be very calm and very attentive, and, you know, I had gotten close to one of them that was in some bushes, and it got so scared, it was making all these awful noises. And I thought, I can't do this. I'm not going to pursue this. I'm not going into those bushes because I'm going to let this being escape. It's too frantic. And that morning I saw them out the front window of the bedroom, and they were standing there up near some trees in the front yard, some little pine trees. And so I went downstairs and looked through the front door window, and they were still there. So I went out onto the porch. This is in a country. There's nobody else around. And they were still there. I stood on the porch and I could see they were wiping their arms. I went closer and they didn't move. They kept wiping their arms. I could now smell a faint odor of something acrid that could have been ammonia very easily. It was like that. It was a sort of acrid smell. And I thought to myself, my God, they're letting me walk up to them. So I walked even closer and I observed this. There was crystalline material coming out onto their arms and they were brushing it off like this, brushing it off their arms. And it did smell like ammonia. Okay, there was another researcher, Bud Hopkins, who was very interested in abductions. And I told him about this and I said to him, and I think they may have even communicated this to me, that this the way they relieved themselves. And I said, this is the way they relieved themselves. And he was utterly disgusted. And he said to me, oh, Whitley, that's your imagination. You got to rein in your imagination. So I forgot about it. I never said another word about it. He never wrote a word about it. I never wrote a word about it. 30 plus years later, I opened the Reddit document. And it starts with a detailed description of this process. And exactly what I saw. And that was when I realized the document has got to, in some way, be real. So, very interesting. And from there, I was able to work through the document bit by bit and compare what I have seen to what's in the document. And build for the first time in the world a picture in words of the structures, biological structures of non-human beings.
And is that document somewhere on the internet? Can anybody get access to it?
I'm sure it's in the back of my book. I don't know. It's probably on Reddit somewhere still, but it's certainly in my book. It's in an appendix to the book.
So if they're telepathic and they're kind of a hive mind.
It's not the word hive implies a sameness. That is not the case. It's not like that. It is a communal agreement to think together. And these are all separate personalities. I've been in that community and it's not like a hive at all.
So if they had a particularly difficult problem, they could join together and all analyze it and work out a solution together rather than just trying to rely on some genius to do it.
The solution creation, creating of solutions is mostly instantaneous with them because of the linked brains. Not always though, and especially when they come across something new, they're not particularly good at reacting to the new because there are too many different opinions, especially when they come to something that they've never seen before. It can be very slow and can take years and years. And that's what they're up against with us. We are something new and they have plenty of trouble coming to a decision about how to understand us and think about us. They're just slow going down that path very slowly.
You say in the book that they can control their body's density and appearance in ways that we cannot. Is that done with their minds?
I don't know. I have to tell you. I've seen it. And I know other people who have seen it. But as to how it's done, that's another story.
I suppose they could control your density if they were abducting you and taking you through a wall or the ceiling or something.
I don't recall being taken through a wall, but I do know people who do recall having that happen. Yeah. Now that I think about it, but the specific experience doesn't come to mind right now.
And you also say that they have different brains than we do. So
yes, they do.
They also seem to have a different relationship with reality.
Well, yeah. Let me give you an example of what I mean by that. A dolphin has a big brain, and two hemispheres like we have, large, complex brain. But We can't communicate with them. We don't know how. Because they have a completely different relationship to reality. Their brain is structured differently. That structure, different structure, means that they are receiving information from the outside in a different way than we are. If you take a dog, your dog sees the world in an entirely different way than you do. Your cat does. An insect sees the world in a different way than we do. And the individual people see the world in very different ways. So there's an enormous communications gap. You can't just sit down with one of them and chat. It doesn't work that way. And along with this communications gap is a fundamental difference between the way the worlds work. Like, I have been integrated into that collective a couple of times, and you see the world completely differently. It doesn't look like this, not at all. There's all kinds of things in the world that we don't see that they do see. And when you're in that with them, you see them too. But the difference is they understand them and you don't. So the world becomes very confusing very quickly when you're integrated into their collective.
Yeah, because you say in the book, they see the world outside the stream of time. And I can imagine that would be overwhelming.
Exactly. It's horrendous. I've been there for a few seconds. And it's a fish out of water situation if ever there was one. It's appalling. All of a sudden, you're riding on rails. Nothing is new. You already know what's going to happen. It's absolutely terrifying.
They already know what's going to happen. It's like they know everything in a way, and it's like, well, what new? What is there new for us if we already know everything that's happened in time?
Nothing is new for them. Everything is always new for us. Every single second is new for us. Every single second. But not for them. Nothing is new for them. They want to share us with us. They want to share themselves with us so that they can dip into the time stream and feel the new in the same way we do. They're very, very eager to do that. My wife called this process communion, and she understood it from the very beginning. And that's why the first book I wrote about this is called Communion, because she understood that. And they want to experience a state of communion with us.
So if they have this view that's outside of reality, so to speak, outside of our reality, do they have knowledge and access to what we would call the afterlife and deceased loved ones?
Apparently so, because you often see them in the context of the dead. I will give you an example of this. Back after I published Communion, before the internet, it was not easy to get a hold of somebody like me. There was no email. If you wanted to get a hold of me, you had to send a letter and you had to know where to send it. So I published my address in the back of Communion so people could send me letters. In any case, I got a call from my literary agent saying that there was a man who was desperate to talk to me. And this man had taken the trouble to find my literary agent. And, you know, I'm not an unapproachable guy. I'm not going to hide. So I said to the literary agent, give me his number and I'll call him. And I called him. And he had this story to tell. He said he was an FAA inspector. He worked in airlines. And he said, last week, my wife and I were in the living room. It was about 10 o'clock and our dog was asleep on the hearth. She's an old dog and she's a creature of regular habits. And suddenly she became agitated and needed to go outside for a second time, which was unheard of. She never did that. But I took her out, or my wife took her out. And as she was leaving, she saw what she thought was a plane going in on fire. And she called back to me and said, honey, there's a plane going in on fire. You're going to get a call in a few minutes. Because he would have been the first person they called. No call came in. Instead, his little seven-year-old boy came running downstairs saying, Mommy, Daddy, Mommy, Daddy. I woke up and little blue men had Tommy with them and they brought him into my room. And he said to tell you he was all right. And they wanted to know if they could believe this story, because the older boy had died the week before in a car accident. And these beings are present in the level of the soul, definitely. And I was able to tell them, yes, what happened to you is probably entirely real, but I don't think it'll bring your son back. So there is a definite connection between the dead and the visitors. Definite.
It's been great having you on the podcast. And again, the book's called The Fourth Mind, and people can get that wherever their books are sold, I suppose.
Yes. Well, thank you very much for having me. Let's see, the place to get the book is on Amazon.
Great. Okay. Well, I'll put a link to it in the show notes so people can find it easily.
Good.
And that was an interview with Whitley Strieber about his book, The Fourth Mind. And a great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can get exclusive access to the extended version of this episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienUFOpodcast. When you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And if you want to try out the extended episodes, you can now get a 7-day free trial. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and the link is in the show notes. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review, and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.